I think that that's been one of the most profound understandings, openings since Finn's death. He chose to take his own life just before his 17th birthday, so it was a choice he made. It would never have been the choice I would have made for him. And then letting myself be in service to the truth of what really happened, right? Not arguing with it, not wishing it were another way, not pushing it away, not turning away, but showing up to meet it as it was, I think, as it is still in this moment, has been this practice in that kind of faithfulness that I'm talking about then in that poem, where I don't get to write the story the way I wanted the story. So how do I put my faith in what is this mystery of how things are exactly as they are?
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Free Radical Podcast. Today, I'm joined by award-winning poet, teacher, and speaker, Rosemary Wattala Trummer. Rosemary is a poet, teacher, speaker, and writing facilitator who co-hosts Emerging Form, a podcast on creative process. She has been writing and sharing a poem a day since 2006. A practice that especially nourished her after the death of her teenage son in 2021. Her daily poems can be found on her blog, 100 Falling Bales, as well as in a curated version with optional prompts featured in her daily audio series, The Poetic Path, available through the Ritual app. Her poetry has appeared in various publications and has won several awards. Her most recent collections are All the Honey and The Unfolding. As Poet Laureate for Evermore, Rosemary helps others explore grief, wonder, and love through poetry. She has been an organic fruit grower, a newspaper and magazine editor, and a parent educator for parents as teachers. She earned her MA in English Language and Linguistics at UW Madison. Her three-word mantra is, "I'm still learning." And if limited to one word, adjust. It was a momentous meeting with Rosemary. We explored in a very natural, beautiful, like-minded way themes from grief to suffering to love to praise to wonder to trust to confidence to her own life journey to my own life journey to how not only to write poetry but live poetry. What that implies, how to deal with the unknown and show up courageously and vulnerably, and all that you can imagine in between these topics. So please take your seat, brace yourself, fasten your seatbelts, and be ready for a new beautiful session of the Free Radical Podcast. And to support it, please subscribe to our channel by clicking on the bell. If you feel inspired, touched by the conversation, feel free to share it, to like it, and to drop your comments so we can continue this conversation for what it is, for what it has been, and for what it will always be, an ongoing disclosure and dialogue with reality. So without further ado, dear friends, here is Rosemary Wattala Trummer. Dear Rosemary, thanks so much for coming. Welcome to the Free Radical Podcast.
Thank you. I am so grateful to join you today.
I'm grateful as well, and as we attempt to indicate with the title of the podcast, Free Radical, Radical, I know you are a lover of words as I am, so comes from the Latin radix, which means root. So how to be radical means how to get to the core of things and hopefully free radical in a free way to do so, and in a way that makes us even more free after the exploration. So it's my hope and my prayer that today's conversation will help us to dig layer a little bit more deeper and make us a little bit more free.
Beautiful, beautiful. I love that image.
So I generally like to introduce my guests to my listeners. How did I come to know about each of them? And in your particular case, of course, I don't have yet the fortune of getting to know you in person. I hope that may happen at some point. We may cross paths in 3D, but I came to know about you first by a poem of yours, found in the at the beginning of Father Richard Rohr's latest book, The Tears of Things. And I loved the poem, and then I read the book, and of course the poem was completely accurate, but I didn't know much about your life story, your background story. And then recently I read a book by Mirabai Starr, Ordinary Mysticism, where she speaks about, quotes a poem of yours, but especially also concentrates on your life story. And then knowing your background, I went back to your poem in The Tears of Things, and it helped me reach again another layer of full circle and valuing even more, not only your poem, but your contribution. And yeah, and from that place, I felt inspired to contact you. And I think after our first email exchange, you already called me friend. So here we are.
Thank you. And what a joy to learn of you and then to listen to your podcast. I've been enjoying it myself and I
Thank
appreciate
you.
what you're doing.
Thank you. And I like to ask you that. I always like to ask that to my guests as well. What brings you today? Why you have chosen to join me in the conversation? Because of course you can always say no to an email from a swami. So I'm curious. I'm curious what brings you to today to the table today.
First of all, I can't actually imagine saying no to your email. There was no part of me that thought no. So it was a delight to receive your email and then to read about you and read some of your work, listen to you, and I thought, oh, look, here's someone else who wants to be curious to meet the world with an open heart, to find other ways of opening up the ideas, what we think we know, and moving through into what we don't know. It was exciting. I'm so grateful to join you.
Thank you. Yeah, it's always an adventure and it's always a blessing. I mean, I cannot think of any blessing that is not adventurous, right? So thank you. And before we proceed, if you, I think it's time for me to warn my listeners about you, about Rosemary, warning to each one of you, including myself. And for that, I will ask you, Rosemary, to read a poem from your latest book, The Unfolding, about warning, page 21.
Okay.
Probably you already know where we are going now.
Okay. This poem is called Warning Label.
Yes.
In the small print that doesn't appear on my wrist when you shake my hand, it says, not advised for those with low tolerance to weeping. It says, for those allergic to intimacy, low dosage recommended. It says, close contact is associated with a high risk of being included as a subject in poems. Oh, blah, blah, blah. Everything comes with a warning label these days. So many potential risks when we connect, like irrational happiness, like loss, like grief, like a deepening love that will never go away.
Thank you. So all of you have been now officially warned.
You've been warned.
Fasten your
What do you think
seatbelt,
what would your
brace
warning label
yourself.
say, do you think?
Sorry again?
What would your warning label say?
What will be my own warning label? Well, I will say, I mean, I don't want to compare myself with you. Each one is our unique being, but probably a reason why it resonated so much. I resonated so much with that particular poem and chose to bring it here now is because I probably find myself warning people along those same lines, so to say, right? Like there is a price for this meeting, so to say. We'll end up both paying by trying to be vulnerable and truthful and honest, and we may end up discovering things that invite us for a deeper level of surrender and dying to older versions of ourselves. And as you say, embracing the unknown and letting go and releasing outdated versions. So it can be terrifying, but at the same time, it's worth pursuing. So I'm all for that. So if you want to get closer to me, that's my warning. So that's kind of the
okay. So, okay. Here yeah. I am.
You put it in way better ways. I really appreciate that.
Thank
so
you.
Now that's the warning has been made. You listeners still have time to step away if you want. We are not imposing anything of you. But if you stay, you do so knowing the risks, no? A journey of no return, basically, right? Into authenticity, into the embrace of intimacy, sacred grieving, connectivity, and love. Last mm-hmm. line on love, of course, including all of that. So we have been warned about you, and you've shared what brings you to this conversation. But if you allow me 1 minute, Rosemary, I'd like also to share what brings me to the conversation today, not only why I felt inspired to call you, but particularly today, talking with you as a poet. And I personally want to be a poet. Actually, interestingly enough, my first published writing, I've been publishing a few books the last few years, I'm 45 now, but my very first published writing was when I was like, I don't know, 16. And it was in a book of poetry, right?
Oh.
In Spanish, in Argentina, the poem was called Divine Salvation. But anyhow, that's part of the timeline. But I personally want to be a poet. And what do I mean by that? Not so much a poet like for the label or for the brand of it, but for what it actually means to like to become a poet. Some people, of course, may acknowledge and appreciate poetry. Some other people may read poetry, may go a step further. Some other people may go further still and write poetry. But for me, there are others who may do all of that, but also do something else. And those are for me the poets with a capital P and probably capital O-E-T-S, etc. For me, are not merely appreciators or readers or writers of poetry, but are also like livers of poetry. They live poetry. And I like to invent words. I know you also do. So another kindred spirit in this regard. So in that way, I like to be a poet. For me, to live poetry is not like to, I don't know, to inhabit a naive, like la 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 fantasy world. But as a dear friend of mine, she said once, to fall in love in an absolute way with the totality of reality to the point of tears.
Oh.
Like after I read that, I almost went down to the floor and internally that was too much. To fall in love in an absolute way to the totality of reality to the point of tears, right? And of course there are different expressions of love and there are different types of tears. Shrichar will say the tears of things. So yeah, that's the poem, basically.
Oh, I think the poem. Really.
As they say, no, like someone who writes becomes a writer. Someone who prays becomes a prayer. So a poet has to become a poem somehow, right? So that's the kind of poem I like to become. I'm not saying I'm there, and I will argue. Maybe you will never. If you are a real poet, you will never feel I'm there. Finally, I've colonized the realm of poetry. But that's my aspiration, confessing this to you and to my audience here, someone hopefully who can fall in love genuinely with the totality of reality to the point of tears, and with everything, again, not only with what is beautiful, what is pleasant, or what is dopamine-inducing, but also, as you say, with loss, betrayal, sorrow, mm-hmm. grief. So, and again, not falling in love with grief out of masochism, but trusting that love can love everything. Can hold space for everything, can create spaciousness for everything. And that, everything can be properly understood and redeemed when it's loved, right? Mm. So, and in so many ways, I believe your poetry does exactly that. So that's where I'm here.
Do it better than I do.
No. That's where I'm here today, from where I'm coming. And I don't know, in your case, what does it mean for you to to recognize yourself as a poet, or to continuously aspire to become a poet.
Yeah, it is that, I suppose, a continuous aspiration, and also knowing that it's also exactly what is here always, right? Mm. Of course, I mean, I think that it was interesting you used this word brand earlier.
Mm.
As for so long, and maybe even still, I sort of resisted the word poet, maybe because it sounded too grand or too something. That's almost silly, because of course I write a poem now for 20 years every single day. Before that, I had also written books, but everything about the practice changed when I began a daily practice.
Yeah.
And so clearly I'm a poet. I have a bunch of books. I write a lot of poems. But that is what was the most beautiful part for me about beginning a daily practice. And it didn't happen right away, but was I came to understand that it wasn't about the poem itself at all, that the poem was just the byproduct. And it was a byproduct of the real practice, which is showing up, which is wondering, what is here? What is here? Wondering it over and over and over. What is here? What's inside? What's outside? How does a poem become a bridge between these two worlds that we continuously recreate? And so in this way, you know, with a, I mean, I've written how many thousands of poems at this point, and do they all overlap each other? Of course they do. But, you know, how many poems can one person write about the moon? Well, apparently hundreds or thousands even at this point. But but are they all different? Of course they are, because every single time I show up to meet what is here, and it involves whatever it is, the moon and a joy, or the moon and a loss, or the whatever it is, there's this constant ability, willingness, curiosity, what is here now? What is here now? And so it brings us into that present moment again and again, and we're new, and the moon is new. That relationship between us is new. So that it's a constant curiosity, ever evolving.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the word in the beginning, showing up, right? Which I really appreciated, because I immediately related it with a definition that Brené Brown, you may have heard about her, and she defined vulnerability, like showing up when you don't have a control over the outcome.
Right.
Right. Like to have the courage to show up when you don't have the control over the outcome. That's vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, yeah, that was what it means to be a poet, basically. Right. To have the courage to show up to the unknown, to the new, with curiosity, childlike curiosity, but showing up. And you don't know what will happen, what you will end up writing your daily poem. You have zero clue, but you dare to show up, right?
Which is, I think this has become one of the most important parts to me also. And I think there was a time when I only wanted to sit down to write a poem if I knew it was going to be good. I wanted to sit down only when I had this inspiration to write. And I had an inspiration, and I thought, oh, that'll make a good poem.
Mm.
Versus I sit down and I have no idea what's going to happen. That used to be terrifying for me. Now it's so exciting. Now it's the thrill. Now it's what brings me back to a blank page every day, is I have no idea what will happen. And if I do have some idea what will happen, then I tell myself, okay, go ahead, you know, honey, write that. But then you have to go past it. Then you have to keep writing into what you don't know. And this is how I feel like the poem itself becomes a practice into vulnerability, and becomes a practice of opening to, I'm going to say, the mystery. Earlier you said the totality, but opening to what's beyond what I already have the capacity to know. And now things get exciting. Then, and almost every time, there's some moment of, that's what's here. And that's the moment that I love the most when I'm writing. You know, it's so boring to write what we already know. I call that reporting. That's actually not all that interesting. But to write what we know and then let it lead us into the unknown, that's every time thrilling.
Yeah, there's a phrase that came while hearing you, which is something like excitement lies on the other side of certainty, right?
Yes.
Or beyond the shore of certainty, whatever. You will be put it more poetically than I. But and we are all like dying for excitement, basically. We are like thirsty for that. But it's on the other side of certitude, right? So there's a price to pay for excitement. And when we want cheap excitement, which is excitement in comfort zone and excitement in the context of whatever is predictable and controllable, it looks exciting, but now it's never fulfilling, right? So
That's a good way to say that.
yeah. And it's funny because we are talking about poetry, but in my own spiritual practice and connection with mystical traditions, all the things we are talking could be exactly copy-pasted and used to describe a faith experience, a mystical journey. And then we start to realize how all these things are intertwined, and we are not talking about two different departments, basically. Right?
Right. Well, I think in part it's when anyone has the willingness to show up and wonder, what does it mean to be alive? Not that we answer the question, of course. Not that we ever answer it. Or certainly if we answer it, we answer it only for the slightest barest moment of touching the truth before it's all slipped away and there's so much more, right? But just to again and again meet that question, whether we're doing that through poetry or dance or prayer, or I think that it does have that same resonance, that same I'm looking for the word that is this gesture.
Let's create the new one right now. No problem. We're all waiting for that moment. I really appreciate it. We will go there in a moment, but about the really pressing need to create new words to express certain things. And even when we create the new word, we know that there is much more beyond the new word that we have just created, right? As I like to say, reality is always expanding and evolving, so we cannot keep pace fully with that unfolding, so to say. Also, I'm thinking about the notion of imagination in connection to poetry and to life itself. And again, as I said before, poetry is not fantasy in the sense of escaping reality. So for me, the idea of imagination is similar. Imagination is not like, oh, you are indulging in your imagination. That's bypassing of reality. But actually, for me, imagination is rather the science fiction is more like, or nor flight from reality, nor fight with reality, nor freeze in reality, but imagination as the courage to conceive the deepest possible possibilities of everything. No, look more again, vulnerability, courageousness, like showing up, the imagination is daring to think what's the most, as much as I can imagine, of course, with my limitations, but what's the deepest possibilities of anything and everything in their unfolding, right? So for me, poetry is the exact opposite of fantasy in that sense of escapism. For me, poetry is a hyper realistic project. I don't know if you have any thoughts in that
Oh
connection.
yeah, totally. So I love that you bring this in, and what a beautiful definition of the imagination, which is really exploring infinite potential. And so what often I like to say, the promise I started to make myself at some point, Swami, after I had been, writing, and I realized, well, I wasn't going to be able to write something good every time. So if I wasn't just writing something to be good, what was I doing anyway? What was it for? Then the invitation I gave myself was, well, it doesn't have to be good. It just has to be true. This became very interesting to me, right? To write something true every time because I could do that. But then it got me to think of, okay, well, what does it mean to be true? Knowing that if I could write something true, I could write its opposite, and often that was also equally true. Well, this is paradox. which is life. and then also this idea of the imagination. How can the imagination be true? So when I say I'm writing something, you know, I can write something true, that doesn't necessarily mean factual. That means I am writing it to follow that, whatever that thread is. By thread, I'm saying whatever that energetic thrust is, not trying to impress you, not trying to impress myself, but to be honest, to be authentic to what is this that's coming through. And it's that authenticity that I'm most interested in. And that authenticity can drive the imagination, right? What if? That's every time we let ourselves ask, what if, we've allowed ourselves to move into the realm of imagination, past whatever little story we thought we had. Well, what if we say this? What if we try this? What if? So that becomes something that happens in the form of a poem, but it also becomes the way that I think we begin to see beyond our ideas of the stories that we've been telling ourselves about the way the world is. And then we let ourselves wonder, well, what if I, you know, what if it's this? What if it isn't this? What if? Wow. What if? Yeah.
Yeah. Is there an alternative to the official narrative, so to say, that I've been maybe telling to myself and right. engaged myself in that for decades? So, yeah, right. I recently read a book by a Christian theologian, Walter Brueggemann, called The Prophetic Imagination. Very interesting one. And he will mention things like, I don't know, in our modern day society, and the book was written like decades ago, but we are very expert at implementing almost everything, but at imagining almost nothing. No? So we are a very efficient society. We can implement, do so many things, but in terms of imagination, an imagination should come before implementation.
Mm-hmm.
So, right. so I think the role of poetry in this is crucial, because it's invites to imagine and reimagine and reimagine.
Right.
Because sometimes we live in a certain narrative, then we imagine an alternative, we pursue it, but eventually that becomes the statu quo, so to say, and we need another poem, another layer of imagination to explore deeply, and so on and so forth.
This has been such an important part of the poetic path for me, Swami, because I think about how easily we become set in a metaphor, and we don't understand that that's what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
Briefly, I'll just say that the brain works in terms of metaphors. So whether you're a poet or not, you are already dealing in metaphors. If you speak a language at all, any language, all language is metaphor.
Yeah.
So all of us are native metaphor workers. Then I start to hear a story like, what's a recent one? Just recently, I remember thinking, I was just at a concert, and I remember I had been looking for beauty and good in the world. I had this kind of longing to find it for some proof, because there was some, let's be honest, there's some really tough stuff happening. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just collecting, just noticing, just letting myself be aware again and again and again. Yes, there are all these difficult things, and there's also this, and there's also this. And so I was at this concert, and I'm just feeling like I'm like beauty and goodness is being poured into me from this beautiful violin player and piano player. I was listening to them and just how stunning it was. And I was like, oh, I'm a cup receiving all of this goodness. And then I thought, well, sure, I'm a cup, but I could be a pitcher, and then I can pour it all out also for everyone else. So just noticing that there's this one little metaphor took hold. Oh, I'm a cup. I can receive. I can receive. I can receive. But then the invitation for it to shift. Oh, I can offer. I can give. I can give. I can give. This is just a recent one, but I want to say that it comes up all the time in other things that we think, like, I can hold it all. That this is a common one for me. I remember hearing myself say it, I can hold it all. And I remember, especially when I was going through a very difficult time, imagining myself then as a vase that was going to hold all of these stems of all these different emotions, the stem of the flower of anger and love and beauty and fear and wonder and loss, all of it, right? And I was going to hold it all. And I just kept making myself a bigger, bigger face. And honestly, it was getting to be utterly exhausting trying to hold it all. Mm-hmm. And then my teacher, Joy Sharp, my spiritual teacher, said to me, "Are you sure you need to hold it all?"
Yeah.
It was such a beautiful moment, that teaching, when the vase just dissolved. I was like, I don't have to hold it. I don't have to hold it. And and immediately it was as if I became this incredibly porous sense of this porousness, this porous sensibility where things could just move through. I didn't have to hold a thing. And it shifted, not the world, of course, but the way that I meet the world.
Big lesson. Thank you for that. Because yeah, so many times we are drawn to the holding it all template. And I mean, with a good heart, with good intentions, but to begin with, it's not possible.
There's
always the question, like, why? You know, right? Why do I feel that I need to hold it all? Or why do I feel I must? Why? What's behind the holding it all, right? So, yeah. I'm thinking, Rosemary, many things about what you are saying, but going to your poetry for a moment, and not only your poetry, but any good poetry, including your poetry, of course, and listens closely to detail, right? Which for me is an important point, because to the apparently insignificant, to the apparently ordinary, listens closely to it. So for me, this is another way of saying that poetry demands absolute presence for it to be poetry, for you to be really there and capture what's happening in front of you. So it requires this absolute presence to the hidden layers of what is, again, unfolding in this very moment and beyond what merely appears to be there on the surface. So I'm thinking about the word, and you tell me your thoughts. No, I don't want to speak about poetry like if it sounds like a military training, but I think there is some form of being trained in poetry in terms of, again, encountering the day-to-day, not necessarily some professional guidance, which also can be there. But again, you have been writing, as you just already say, you have been writing one poem per day for more than 20 years, I think. So for me, to have that, it's a discipline in showing up. Again, it's a discipline encounter the present moment, the unknown, discipline to, again, choose to be open, to wonder. So for me, it feels in one way, there are some parallel with the yogic practice of steady discipline of attention and presence and training of the mind, devotion to what truly matters. So I don't know if you have any thoughts in terms of the balance or the dance between discipline in poetry with flow, you know? Because sometimes we may think poetry is just flow. And again, many times it's you're staring at the blank page and what to do now, I don't know. And the relationship between discipline, flow, or perhaps one in the service of the other, however you live this.
Yes, beautiful question. So discipline, of course, coming from the root to teach, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, I suppose, ever my wonderment is to the world, what do you have to teach me? So showing up with that question, but the truth is it takes, that's the sweet part of it, right? That's the curious part of it. But the discipline of it is you do need to sit your butt down in a chair and be present and wonder, not only in that moment though. And that's the other part of it that I really appreciate about a poetic discipline is that we actually don't arrive blank to the page. We arrive there with everything that's happening up until that moment, so that we bring that wide circle of experience and feeling and curiosity that we've been having, well, let's just say actually our entire life until we meet this very moment when we're like, okay, what's here now? The discipline of it is just saying, okay, I will sit and I will wonder and I will bring it all in and I will let it all come, and I will wonder about it until words arrive. That's part of the discipline. The other part of it would be, for me, is reading widely poets who I respect, poets who I think are far better than I am, who continually teach me with their words and how they do what they do. And so bringing that knowledge into the, and that skill, I guess, you know, the skills that I get from reading them and thinking, oh, look what they did. How did they do that? So bringing that in so that when I'm meeting the moment, I have more skill in meeting the moment with language. So I think, yes, of course, there is this flow and it's lovely, especially when there are moments where we sit down and we're like, oh, and we just write and write and write and it's all just coming through. Most of the time, it's not actually like that for me anyway. Most of the time when I'm writing, it looks like me sitting still like this for a long time, just letting myself be wrestled by what's happening. What is showing up? What isn't showing up? What do I want to show up? And what's really happening? You know, the difference between those. So that dance. So yes, I think the discipline of it really is the commitment to sit down, to say, okay, I will give this, and I give it whatever time it takes. So I think some people, there's so many ways to do this right, of course. My own practice works best when I have it as open-ended as possible so that I sit down and then I know I have as much time as I want because I write last thing in the day. I like to write at the very end of the day so that there are no appointments. There's nothing else calling my attention except sleep so that I know that I can take all the time I need to, with the poem.
So you've been doing this, Rosemary, for 26 years already?
Well, it's 20 years of it. I began in 2006, the Daily Poems. Yeah, in February of 26. So it's just this month is
happy anniversary.
The 20-year mark. But I've been writing poems, you know, since fourth grade when I first fell in love with writing poems.
Yeah.
But the daily practice, which really is what changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can really appreciate that. And I saw that your tagline, you say, for your daily commitment was like, there is a poem in every day, which I love that because not only you are doing, you have a vow, so to say, or a commitment to write one poem per day, but the trust and hope that there is a poem in every day. So every day, every single day invites us to a life of poetry, basically.
Exactly. To become the poem, like you said earlier.
Yeah. And I can really relate to that because I have not done what you've done, but a few years ago, it was during COVID times, somehow it was not in my plan, but I got stuck in one place, actually in this place. I couldn't travel basically anywhere, so I was planning to be here a week and I ended up being here half a year, living in an RV on my own for half a year. It was a very interesting experience. That's when I wrote my first book. But I also simultaneously felt inspiration to commit myself to a daily writing. And in this case, it was not so much a poem per day, but there is one particular poem in our tradition, one main famous verse given by one of our main masters, which speaks about the ideal spirit to praise the divine. We'll get to the word praise in a moment, I'm sure. And he will say something, if I can repeat it to you, he says something like, I mean, I'm translating the original Sanskrit. Be as humble as the quiet grass, as enduring as the ancient tree. Seek not the praise of man, but honor every soul you see. And with this heart, sing the name of Hari endlessly. Hari is a name for the divine that means he who takes away, or thief also, like thief of hearts, basically, right? So anyhow, it's a verse about, again, humility and tolerance and compassion and honoring. And it's a simple, short one, but for us, it's kind of a golden rule. Like every religion has their golden rule. So I felt I will write one whole page, the notebook, every single day for a whole year about my reflections on the same verse over and over again. And it was incredible. And it was incredible how much came from just drilling in the same quote unquote piece of poetry just for 1 year and discovering a new poem, a new verse 365 times in 1 year, right?
So, okay, that's so exciting. I love that you did that. What do you,
I love what, that I example. Mean,
to be, first of all, such a relationship then with that piece of writing.
Yeah. Yeah, you develop such intimacy and familiarity. I mean, like becomes ingrained part of you, right?
And I'm guessing, and you can tell me where I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that there were times where you're like, really, is there anything else here? And then there would be. Is this true?
Yeah, of course. Again, I'm not here boasting that it was flowing and every day just newer and newer layers of ever evolving revelation came. No, there were days, as you say, like, will I be able to say something else today, to write something else? And yeah, it was there.
And yes. And that is how the trust builds, right? This is how the trust in the process builds. This is how, and to me, that trust is the piece that changes everything the most, right? Now, what I know each time I sit down to a blank is something will happen. Something will happen.
Yeah.
Something unexpected will happen.
Yeah.
And I trust that. Even so, I have no idea what it's going to be.
Yeah.
But I know something will. It doesn't mean it's going to be good. No, but something is going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's a very necessary, how to say, element, being that everything else is absolutely uncertain, so to say, to have a foundational trust in showing up, that I know something will show up. As I show up, something will show up. But beyond that, I have no clue about anything. How that will happen, when. But we have to have some foundational trust, because if that trust is not there and everything else is uncertain, without that foundational trust, everything becomes uncertain. And that's too much unknown, so to say.
Yeah. We may the foundational collapse. Trust. Mm-hmm. Exactly so. Beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember one Christian mystic, Henry Nouwen, will say, speaking about unconditional love, and from his Christian perspective, God's unconditional love, and he will say, the only certainty is that we are being unconditionally loved. Everything else is uncertain. Mm-hmm. But that foundation should be enough to deal with everything else being uncertain. So we better work on that foundation.
So let's work on that foundation. Yeah.
Your work is like the trust, right? The intrinsic trust that something will show up, even when everything seems to be collapsing, and we will go there in a minute about your own personal journey in terms of certainties disappearing and situations being completely unexpected, and still something is showing up, and we develop some trust to that, right? But we, of course, in one sense, we have been so far trying to say something about poetry, or trying to define what poetry is. At the same time, for me, of course, just trying to define poetry sounds like I don't know, maybe even insulting to what poetry actually is. It's like defining poetry is as elusive as defining love, right? I remember this poem by Rumi. He will say, with my pen, I was trying, he wouldn't even say I was trying to define love, but he would say, with my pen, I was trying to write the word love. And then when I tried to write the word, the pen broke. What to speak of trying to define the word love, just trying to write the word, just you are starting to label it, to put it into a box, to assign letters. No?
Yeah. The poem will defy them every time, for sure.
Yeah.
So although reality, I don't know the poetry minds that we try, I just think it probably laughs at any thought that we never arrive at a definition.
It's a journey of further arrival, I will say, right? We can always arrive, but there's always a further arrival And I think, again, as a poet, that's one of the main humbling, holy duties of a poet, right? Like to acknowledge, okay, reality itself resists closure, right? Yeah. Definition. It begs to keep the door open. It begs for ongoing disclosure, and that's extremely humbling, right? Because that's the only way it could work. If we go that, if we enter into the arena of poetry without the willingness to allow reality to be what it is, it's like, that's it. That's the end of the game.
I think I begin every poem knowing it will be a failure, right? That it will never be whatever it is I'm trying to, right? The poem I write about I'm looking at the garden. The poem I write about the garden will never be a garden, right? The poem I'm writing about love is never going to be love. And every single time, though, we sit to meet the world, there is that moment when we, well, not always, I suppose, but the thrill when we touch it, when we just touch the truth, and then the whole body does this, right? It's like the whole body tunes into a turning fork. Turns into a tuning fork, and we have that kind of full resonant, like, oh, moment, you know. And I think those are the moments when we're like, oh, that's it. We touched the truth just for that moment. It's so exciting, and you know, it never lasts. Yeah. It doesn't stay, but in that moment, oh,
yeah.
Yeah. But the poem will always fail every time. So we write the next poem.
But it's a failure that, as they say, is the pillar of success, so to say. So, yeah, failure. And yeah, for me, success, again, is not a finished product or like a dead end, but it's like an ongoing thirst for more. So it's the paradox that you referred to before, right? Like life is, in one sense, we are all after fulfillment and joy and happiness and love. But if you attain love, love in itself has its own, a thirst of its own, and always begs for more, can always love more, kind of. So creates a type of holy dissatisfaction, right? But it's holy. So yeah, talking about paradox, again, going of course to your personal life journey at one point in your life, I assume, and I heard about from you talking about it, like your journey, your whole identity, sense of being, and also your poetry became marked by the sudden death of your son, Finn. So, and having so far, I only read The Unfolding from your works, though I have also, what's the other title you sent me? All This Honey?
All the Honey.
All the Honey. I'm looking forward to that one. Yeah. In our tradition, we have a lot of imaginary about honey and bumblebees and nectar. And so I'll go there in a minute. But regarding The Unfolding and regarding the situation with Finn, this is, of course, it's clearly a recurring theme in your work, and I would like to invite you in order to further introduce our listeners in this regard and your own feelings and your own way to relating to grief. If you could share with us one of those grief poems, so to say, from The Unfolding. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about one that I read in page 5, called "Some Nights Missing You."
Oh yeah. Do you know, I think I may have never read this one out loud. "Some Nights Missing You" is like the letter that doesn't come. The one I would carefully slit open and slowly unfold, then hold against my chest for a moment before letting my eyes take in the first line, the second, the rest, the last. The letter that would explain everything in language so plain it would make my hands shake with the truth of it. The one that would arrive with a return address so I would know where to respond if I dared. The handwriting even familiar, easily read, with no pages missing, no passages indecipherable. The letter that never once has arrived. A letter I know only by its absence. And the emptiness itself becomes faithful. And the mystery becomes the only signature I trust.
What comes to you after reading it, maybe first time aloud, this beautiful poem?
Yeah. Well, I do think this poem is in alignment with what we've been talking about. In fact, isn't this just what we've been talking about?
Yeah. And with the word trust, interestingly.
And so I'm thinking really of, you know, some part of us longs for the letter that's going to explain everything, you know, the directions that we can read and get it right and do it all right and know what it all is. And then I think the what's largest in us, what's greatest in us, what's most honest in us knows the folly of that. Reading the poem, of course, I'm always interested what lines really pull me in a poem, my own or anyone else's. You know, they're different every time, but this time it was the ending, and the emptiness itself becomes faithful. That strange, beautiful relationship to emptiness, to nothingness, which is, I have such an intense love affair with nothing. Mm-hmm. And that also changed and developed even more after Finn's death. My curiosity about my wonderment with my love for what isn't here, not in an imaginary way, I don't think. Somehow, I mean, really with nothing. And then the flip side of that is everything paradox. The mystery becomes the only signature I trust. It is true. I think that's just, it's exactly right that there's every certainty feels unstable.
Yeah, I'm thinking of one quote by Father Richard Rohr. He will say the opposite of faith is not doubt, but it's certainty. So faith is all about not doubt, but faith is all about not being certain and being willing to coexist with mystery. And as you was, we were talking, trusting the mystery, being patient with mystery. And for me, patience is trusting while waiting. Yeah, I'm waiting, I'm being patient, but I'm trusting while I'm waiting, right? I'm trusting the unfolding. Yeah. Of the mystery.
Which happens, of course, in ways we wouldn't want, right? I mean, I think that that's been one of the most profound understandings, openings since Finn's death. He chose to take his own life just before his 17th birthday, so It was a choice he made. It would never have been the choice I would have made for him. And then letting myself be in service to the truth of what really happened, right? Not arguing with it, not wishing it were another way, not pushing it away, not turning away, but showing up to meet it as it was, I think as it is still in this moment, has been this practice in that kind of faithfulness that I'm talking about then in that poem, where I don't get to write the story the way I wanted the story. Mm-hmm. So how do I put my faith in what is this mystery of how things are exactly as they are?
Yeah. And of course, not to downplay this particular chapter of your journey, but go into how life, the totality of our lives operates. It's all like that. It's never like we thought it should be or it could be and it will be. It's never a straight line. The other day I was listening to a lecture by an Argentinian artist, and he will say, if you observe nature, there are no straight lines in nature. That doesn't exist. It's all curved. It's all like unpredictable, basically, is the idea. It's not like straight that you can calculate and anticipate. And then you see how we humans construct things, and there's so much strict lines trying to make things controllable, predictable, give us a sense of safety and security. And again, we are terrified about those things that lie beyond our control, and we have to make peace with that. Yeah. And of course, I read that poem and many other poems of yours, and though in my personal case, I'm a Swami, so I'm a monk, I do have children, but I have gone through some significant losses, physical people dying, but also losing relationships with people who were very important for me, like spiritual guides, that many things happened. No need to go into the details now, but it was a type of death, not only of in terms of the relationship, but also a death of my own, of who I was, because you are someone in relation to someone else, right? Like mother, son. It doesn't mean that the relationship, your identity as a mother disappeared, but a part of it is invited to, like the GPS will say, recalculating.
Right. Yeah, right. No, this is true. This is so true. And it reminds me, what you're saying reminds me of something that Mirabai said to me shortly after Finn died. She said, the day your son died, a part of you died too.
Yeah.
Of course it did. Of course it did.
And it brings its own layer of existential crisis, apart from the pain, unbearable pain of that particular loss, the bewilderment about, like, who am I now?
Yeah. Right.
Who am I? And I cannot think beyond even till tomorrow. I'm here in the present moment in this pool of uncertainty, even about who am I? So that's very, very uncomfortable. But at the same time, again, as you say, it's such a fire that fire burns, fire reduces things to ashes, but also fire sheds light, brings warmth, transforms, right. Symbol of transformation. For me, I feel that very clearly in your poetry, right? Like even after the worst possible thing happened, in your case, love did not stop growing, as you yourself said, and as one can clearly feel in the lines of your poems, like love changed, love deepened, continued. I think you quoted Gregory Orr in your book. That was in the intro. That was beautiful. I have it here. I'd like to share it if you allow me. It says, not to make loss beautiful, but to make loss the place where beauty starts, where the heart understands for the first time the nature of its journey.
Yeah.
For me, this is a fascinating topic to think about the purpose of suffering. Not that we need to suffer in order to love more and better, but whenever suffer happens to come to knock on our door, one of the purposes of that is to show that love is always more powerful. Not to deny the suffering, not to cancel, but to love can hold space, welcome suffering into the table, right? And hold space. Yeah. I don't know if you have any thoughts in this regard.
I really do. That we were talking earlier about that trust that develops and that foundational trust.
Yeah.
And I feel like I had such a profound teaching of that. When Finn died, there was a few things happened, a few things that I'll point to happened that really helped that trust to find its way all the way in. One was that I had a friend almost immediately reframe his death for me. And we were talking that night. I was on the phone. I was walking outside. I was in Georgia. And there was it was August. So it was hot. And I was walking in the dark. And she said to me right after, she said, "He has given you his love light to carry." Which itself was a profound statement, right? To take his horrific death and turn it into invitation to become part of a legacy of love. He has given you his love light to carry. And in that very moment also, a firefly lit up right in front of my face when she said that word love. He has given you his love light to carry. And I remember just being so stunned by that, right? Like just this little coincidence.
God incidence, I like to call it.
A God incidence. A God incidence. That's a beautiful word. A God incidence. That I couldn't pretend didn't happen, of course. The other thing that was so profound also, so that was kind of to my head, right? That was a message to the head. That love, this too can be an experience that is informed by great love. But the other experience was much more physical body experience, where I had a literal sensation where I just felt I was on that same street the next morning walking. And I had this feeling of just tidal wave of love coming toward me energetically. And I turned around to see it. It wasn't really there, of course, but I could feel it. And it was way too much. And I had this full resistance in me, like, no, like just so much love. And I think I even put my hands up like, no. And it just crashed over me anyway. And I will tell you that the physical sensation of that was so potent, it stayed. That was the thing. And I just had, I don't know how to say these things without sounding strange, but I had all kinds of visions and sensations and experiences that helped me deeply trust that love was there. I knew that it was love. And I had this sensation for a while of being held, like my chest was being held super tight, like a giant fist of love squeezing around my chest. This, like it was holding me together. And it was actually quite intense. And it would be there when I'd fall asleep, and it'd be there first thing in the morning when I woke up, and it was, or all night when I wasn't sleeping. And then I remember one morning it wasn't there. And I was like, no, oh no. Like, why is it gone? And then it came back and it stayed for months. Just the sensation of being held, or also there were these moments, friend, of I remember feeling like love just came in to every cell. It was somehow very obvious. I say obvious, I don't mean that. It was very, what I knew was happening was that love was coming in and surrounding every cell, every molecule of pain, if pain could be a molecule, was surrounded by love, so that none of the pain was gone. It didn't take away any pain, but it surrounded every tiniest part of it. So that it was bearable. So there was so much more. I could talk about this for like three more days with you about just the actual ways then that it would show up during interactions with other people, especially very difficult interactions. Where I realized, oh, I can just trust love to do everything for me right now. And I don't have to, I didn't know what it would look like. I didn't know how I was going to talk to this person, but I knew that I didn't have to, that I could completely trust love would do it, that love would rise up and say what needed to be said. And I could trust that. And that trust, as it happened again and again and again, became deeper and deeper and deeper. I don't know that we could say that I necessarily even have that same trust anymore now, because it was at the point. Or maybe it's just become like breathing and I just know that it's there. I don't know. At the time, it was so alive and so vital and so new and so everything. You know, I think I just became so aware that there was nothing. I called it autonomic life, because I just felt like I was being lived instead of doing any living on my own. Like the part of me that knew how to do things had completely crumbled. And love stepped in and did it for me.
Yeah.
And that part of Rosemary is back, right? She makes choices now. So it's not like it was. But
It makes me think of this story poem of the footprints in the sand that this person asks God, I saw these two person footprints at one point. There were only two. You left me. No, at that time I was carrying you, basically, right? So we needed to be lived through by love. We were carried by it. Yeah, and again, I cannot thank you so much for sharing that. And of course, I look forward to those 3 days where you will be explaining in detail all the things that happened to you. That's a perfect excuse for a 3D meeting. So I won't forget that one. Someday I'm knocking on your door. You know what I'm coming for.
This will be an ecstatic 3 days then.
I'm sure. I'm sure. I'll let you know in advance so we cancel all our plans. So we are fully immersion retreat, 3 day retreat. But yeah, I couldn't avoid connected on whatever ways I can connect it to my own journey. And in those moments of like overwhelming loss again of relationships, not only a teacher, but a whole community supporting the teacher. And I was kind of ostracized and being scapegoat, and I'm on the black sheep side. And suddenly people that I consider my friends like no longer talk to me and stuff like that. And again, the loss of my own sense of identity. And during those weeks and months that follow after, it's you in your own words, but yeah, I felt so much compensation for the loss in terms of how love became present in my life. And I could feel like overwhelmed by the loss and overwhelmed by the love. Both streams hitting simultaneously, right? As you beautifully said, love being able to hold space for the pain, not to cancel it, not to invite me to run away from it, but saying I'm enveloping it, I'm embracing it, and it's safe to feel it in the context of love. In the context of love, it's safe to feel everything, and safe and necessary, because if we don't grieve and we don't go through the necessary rituals for acknowledging loss, like, I mean, we become less and less human, I will say. And we are not learning to integrate. For me, a very important word in my life is integration. So how love allows to integrate, again, to make pain, suffering, grief, everything, not only those types of experiences, but everything be part of a higher synthesis, higher equation, rather than excluding, including, right? Including, it's all inclusive. Love has the capacity to be all inclusive and welcomes everything. So yeah, I'm thinking about a poem in my particular tradition. I mean, it's a whole series of chapters of a book, but the whole book is considered a poem. The book is called Srimad Bhagavatam, and it has 18,000 verses, so it's a long one. But it's basically a Sanskrit poem, and there are five chapters which specifically are kind of considered unanimously, basically, as the zenith of the book, and it speaks about divine love. And it speaks about romantic love in the context of divine love. And it speaks, this section is about the dance, a circular dance between, I like to call the sweet absolute, since sometimes the word God is a little bit associated with ideas that are not my favorite ones. So the sweet absolute and a group of the lovers of the sweet absolute. And it's an invitation for a dance. So the sweet absolute is playing the flute in the middle of the night. He's in the forest and plays a very enchanting flute. And there are groups of village girls who are very sincere lovers, and they hear the flute and they run after the flute, leaving everything behind. So their daily chores are disrupted by the call, the clarion call of love, so to say. And then they arrive, and the sweet absolute is playing the flute and say, "What are you doing here tonight? It's too late. You are ladies with house responsibility, you should return back home." So again, it's like I like to analyze all this in terms of what Richard Rohr will call order, disorder, and reorder. So the ladies are in an order situation, then the flute comes, disorder, disrupting everything. Then they meet him, reorder, but then he sends them back home, disorder, and they argue with him to stay with him and dance and celebrate life. They do so, reorder. At one point, these ladies feel certain level of certainty, like we got him, we attained him, we are attain our beloved certainty. When he feels that, he feels things are getting less interesting. He disappears from the dance. So then they're all running, looking for him in madness, divine love, separation, longing. Then eventually they meet him again. So yeah, it's a very beautiful section that for me illustrates this, how life basically operates, right? There is an order. At one point, the order becomes statu quo. There's a disruption to the order that throws us into the unknown. But that is an invitation to bring a reorder, or an order that is more accommodating, more broad, more deep, where love can expand to newer levels. So I cannot but relate all that to what we were talking about regarding even suffering and grief, and how all that also is meant to take love to new levels.
Yeah, right. Just that the breaking and the opening and the breaking and the opening. Mm. How it, again and again and again.
Yeah.
What a beautiful story that is. What a beautiful sounding poem.
It's beautiful. It's kind of the, as in the Bible, they have the Song of Songs. This will be the Song of Songs in our particular tradition. It's celebrated in India, not only in India, but in India also with dance and like dramatic performance. And they do a whole sometimes like a 1 week festival to represent all the different acts of the drama throughout like 7 days, 4 hours. And it's beautiful because you see the audience and they are totally, I mean, they are not watching a drama. They are living it. They are there and they are going through all the emotions. And it's like, as it's supposed to happen when we read a book or watch a movie or witness a drama, it should be, a portal into our potential, right? So, yeah, and I'm thinking about in my recent book, Evolution in Divine Love, I like to speak a lot about there how the nature of love is ever evolving. We are invited to this prospect of eternal becoming. I'm thinking about grief and loss and love. There's one definition from my tradition that is given about love, which means love is that thing that even when there are all the best reasons for it not to grow, it continues growing.
Right.
Right. So I couldn't avoid thinking about that when you were talking about telling your story, right? Like real love is that thing that even when you bring to the table all the possible obstacles to love, somehow love becomes strengthened by the obstacles. Like a river that you put something and the river starts to gain momentum and continues to flow, right? Yeah. Uncontainable.
Yeah. Isn't that it? We put up the obstacles and it shows up anyway.
Yeah. And we are expert at putting obstacles to love.
Oh, yeah. Very good at it. Over and over.
And again, our hope and our trust is that love will be smarter than my putting up obstacles in overcoming the obstacles. And overflowing. Yeah. Yeah. I like to think that true love, there is sometimes people may speak about the opposite of love and they may say the opposite of love is hate or the opposite of love is fear or the opposite of love is apathy. But I remember once being kind of struck by some thunderbolt insight, which was true love has no opposite. No, true love can only become more of what it already is. Right?
Wow, who said this?
Like, I say that.
You say this.
Sorry, it sounds too self-referential and maybe self-reverential at the end of the day.
I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful you said this.
It came to me. It's not all copyrights to the Sweet Absolute again.
Okay, the Sweet Absolute.
But the notion of, true love has no opposite because there's nothing that can really oppose such force. Right? Yeah. You bring everything you want to oppose to the table and love only gets stronger.
Yeah. I'm having that tuning fork feeling, friend, just like that. Oh, that just kind of resonating with the truth of that. Thank you for that. Thank you for that.
Oh, my pleasure. Actually, I share it to see how you are resonating with that. So,
yeah,
you literally went to the tuning fork.
Full body. Yeah. Mm. Beautiful, beautiful. It feels so true.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the bottom line of hope, so to say, when everything is loss or collapse. Like, I cannot avoid thinking of Viktor Frankl and his man's search for meaning in Auschwitz and deprived of everything, but still there was purpose and meaning to be found in all the atrocities that were happening, and that kept him alive and kept him not only alive but thriving and blooming. Yeah. So yeah.
That's beautiful. Just that.
I've saw Rosemary that in among the endorsers to the unfolding, there are many people that I appreciate. And I know, I mean, some I know, some I appreciate, like Mirabai Star, we are friends, and also Tara Brach is there. And I remember reading her book, Radical Acceptance. Mm-hmm. Last year, I was in a solitary retreat in the Swiss Alps, and that was one of my reading pieces that was like very impactful. And it has a lot to do with what we are talking today. And also, I saw that there is Francis Weller as an endorser. So, and I really appreciate his work. I recently discovered the Wild Edge of Sorrow.
Yes.
And that was like, oh, okay, there is a before and after this.
Yes. Yes. That book was, I listened to it. It's on Audible in his voice. And there were, after Finn died, I know everyone has their own way. Everyone's so different. But for me, I didn't want to read other books. Other books certainly didn't seem to be touching the experience that I was having. Mm. And I didn't read any of them except for Francis's book and listen. And I listened to that, which was possible for me to listen. And I remember I could hardly tell you a thing it said at this point, except I could tell you that every word went in and I thought, yes, this, I really understood in my being what he was saying. And his new book is also really stunning, I'll say too.
Okay.
Absence of the Ordinary. Oh, I might've just gotten it wrong. I can't say
I'll look for it, no problem. Yeah, and I'm thinking, of course, he invokes the language of grief a lot, the symbol, not only a symbol, but the reality of tears, like Richard himself in Slate's book, The Tears of Things. And again, tears many times are often associated with sadness. And I'm not denying that, but also, again, if cried from a proper place, I will say they always encompass love as part of the composition, their equation. Because, of course, we weren't generally crying for something that we don't love, so to say. Right. I'm thinking about one statement, actually, from a book from Jacques Derrida. We are going to a different author now. He wrote a book called Memoirs of the Blind. Interesting book about seeing and so forth. And you have the thing that the whole book, I mean, it may be good or not, but at the end there is one line that even if the whole book was not that good, that whole line justifies the whole reading, but you needed to read till the last page. There's something like the last line almost. He says something like, tears and not sight are the essence of an eye. Tears and not sight are the essence of an eye. Yeah. Any thoughts on this? I don't know what's coming.
Well, right.
Yeah.
I guess partly what I think about that too, I'm thinking about Rainer Maria Rilke, who was early in his career, you know, learned a lot about seeing, how to see the world and poured himself into, you know, what he called in seeing, I think. And it was this focus on what is happening outside and bringing it in. But then eventually in his life, he realized, oh, it's about the heart. I need to bring it into the heart. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's at the core maybe of what Derrida is saying here too, right? Is it isn't just about this perception, although perception of course is important. Maybe we have to have the perception piece before we can move deeply into the heart piece. I don't know that part. But I think that what Derrida and what Rilke were saying is very similar. Yes, of course, the seeing, but the heart, how do we process it through the heart? How do we show up fully with this willingness, with this openness, with this love? How do we meet the world that way with that kind of tenderness, that kind of vulnerability?
And crying as its own way of seeing, right? Because in one sense, paradoxically, if you are crying too much, you are literally not seeing, but you are seeing in the deepest possible way of seeing, right? So,
I am quite a crier, actually, and my beautiful friend Uli likes to say, in Germany they have a saying that if you cry often, your house is built too close to the water, which is, I think, such a lovely way to say it. I'm glad to be built close to the water.
Yeah, totally. I mean, our body is 70 something percent water, so we better get acquainted with our watery nature, right?
And I think one thing that's been interesting to me too about tears in particular, and especially after Finn died, I've always been a crier. That's always been true. But since Finn died, especially sometimes I found I wouldn't want to say, I didn't want to talk about things because it was going to make me cry. And I thought, oh, that's going to make people uncomfortable. And then I started to realize all the things that I most want to talk about, which aren't just grief, right? But just enormous love, which makes me cry just as much, if not more than grief, right? All the things I want to talk about that are most important make me cry. I was like, so what? Am I going to stop talking about the most important things? I'm going to censor the most important things? No, nope. So I just started crying all the time. Just letting it be known that I remember too, there was a dream I had shortly after Finney died where, well, this is a strange thing to say. All right, but I'll say it anyway, because I'm in
No problem. We are all
there
strange people here, me, my audience,
was
so don't
okay.
feel strange. You're at home. No problem.
Perfect. Here we go. Let's more into the strange realm. In the dream, I was in a city, I suppose, where everyone was naked. There was nothing unusual about it. This is how it was. We were all, it was, this is how we were making soup and working in the yard, whatever. And then I remember going through a door, and I was now in the land of people with clothes on, and I realized how they were really, uncomfortable with me showing up naked. And I thought, oh, I'm uncomfortable being with them with all their clothes on too. And so I left that world and went back to the world of the naked people, which I understood profoundly in the morning. Of course, when I woke up, I was like, of course, sweetheart, of course, these are the only people that you actually can safely be with right now are the people who are willing to be unmasked and naked, metaphorically speaking. I remember my dad didn't quite get my dream. He's like, wait, so but I feel like this was the invitation for me, especially in that moment, was stay with these people who are willing to be this vulnerable, this heart opened.
It's beautiful because you mentioned nakedness in this dream you had, and related to the poem I shared before about this dancing from one of our scriptures. A previous section to that divine dance is another situation where there are a group of naked, these same village girls were bathing naked, and this sweet absolute flute player, he goes up. They left all their clothes outside of a river they're bathing, and he takes all their clothes and goes to the top of a tree and plays the flute and says, like, okay, you want your clothes, you have to come and pick them. So they're naked, right? So they go covering their intimate parts, and he says something like, he creates some good reason, like, you have bathed naked in this sacred river, so you have offended the river, therefore you have to beg forgiveness to the river. So with your two arms, you have to put them above your head and beg forgiveness. Like, the idea is he wanted to see the full nakedness, and not masks, not hiding, but come to me, as you are with full nakedness, right? And that led to the consummation of this sacred dance that I shared before. So, but nakedness is required first as a preliminary requisite.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. I remember when I was teaching classes, then shortly after Finney died, I started teaching classes about love, reading love poems. And the people who came to the classes knew what had happened. But the first day of class, I remember saying to them, I told them about the dream. And I said, I tell you this because I need you to know that this is actually the only way I can show up with you now is naked. And if that's going to be a problem, then you can't be here.
That was your warning.
But if you can show,
today, warning.
More warnings. Warning label must be willing to show up naked, yeah. Or at least to be willing to show up with me naked. Mm-hmm. If you can't be, this is okay. But
yeah, but that, you have to that invites that them to be naked themselves, right? Because in one sense, I cannot contact your vulnerability without me being vulnerable, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the trickiness of nakedness, right?
That's true.
That's how it's supposed to happen, yeah. Rosemary, I'm thinking we have talked, of course, about love and grief and nakedness and vulnerability and trust. Also, in your recent work, The Unfolding, you invoke the word praise, especially in the beginning of the book. And even each part of your book, each section of the book is named after a unique form of praise, right? A unique word that you have crafted to indicate different forms of praise. I have here the four of them, Buri Luja, and sorry if I'm pronouncing them wrongly, Sorum, Samunion, and Pangloria. They sound beautiful. So, of course, I have a few questions here, and I assume the listeners as well. First of all, why praise? No? Why the focus on this particular notion of praise? Why the need to create new words to praise? Praise? And maybe if you would like to share a few thoughts about the meaning of these each four words that you've chosen to name your section.
Yes, you bet. Well, so when I was first putting together the collection, I had in mind to create it as a collection that followed the arc of Brian Swim's Powers of the Universe. I don't know if you're familiar with these. And
yeah.
To begin with,
you explained that in your book briefly, right?
Yeah. And you know, there's 11 of them, and my editor said, he's lovely, lovely human. Mark Burrows says, Rosemary, you know, the 11 is actually a little too many, and nobody wants to read a chapter on homeostasis. Of course, I did. I do, but. I thought, okay. And he is the one who said, Rosemary, what about praise? All of these poems are praise poems, it seems so funny that it hadn't occurred to me that that was true. But instantly when he said it, I was like, of course, these are all poems of praise. They are difficult poems, of course, right? The book itself is, there's a deep thread of grief, you know, through the poems, but also so much love in them. So I, you know, in the introduction also, I say that if the baseline is grief, the melody is praise. And there they are together at the same time. So I thought, okay, how could I organize the book around praise? And I thought, you know, I looked up all the words we have for praise in English. And I was really depressed about them. I'm like, really? You know, commend, extol. These words were not singing for me at all. And I thought, and what they also weren't doing was they did not have this kind of more full spectrum dimension of what are we really doing here, right? Yeah. How do we incorporate the all of it into what we're saying.
They
not
are
just
different
to praise.
Forms. There are different forms of praise, basically, right? Because we tend to think praise means this one only thing, and
right,
yeah.
So, for instance, Veraluya, all of the words I created by just blending two words, or two not necessarily words, but two roots. So, ver from veritas from Latin, the truth, and luya from alleluia. Mm-hmm. The definition I give for it then is the praise that rises when we are in a state of raw, naked honesty, aligning with the vast mystery of life as it is, instead of clinging to our story about how we think life is supposed to be. Sarom, you know, from sorrow and om. Mm-hmm. And the idea, I wrote a paradoxical praise for beauty, love, strength, and connection that can only emerge as we wrestle with devastation, grief, the worries and pains of daily living, a positive side effect of surrender and trust in life and death.
I don't want to interrupt you there, but you say om, and I feel tempted to go there because it's such an important word in our tradition. But many people do not know, as you know, and I appreciate your research, or maybe you already knew, that om means, it's a way of saying yes in Sanskrit, yes. Basically. And yes, it's not just like a formal yes in a conversation, but it's a foundational yes. Like begin your life with a yes. No? Hope, trust, yes. And then no's can come and will come. And we need no's, also boundaries, healthy ones, but it has to begin with a yes, right?
It begins with yes. So it's yes.
I'm glad you connected that with the word sorrow, right?
It's yes to the sorrow and the praise that comes only then. And I don't know that before Finn died, I really fully understood that. Mm. But I think this goes back to that Gregory Orr quote, not to make loss beautiful, but to make loss the place where beauty starts, where the heart understands for the first time the nature of its journey. Mm. So that we have this sense of how the wounding itself is the portal to this. Greater foundational trust and love.
Yeah, I like to make a play of words and say that the wound can become a womb, right?
Yes, beautiful. Indeed, indeed. Mm. All the beauty that has come, never the loss itself, no, it's not beautiful. The loss itself, no. Mm. The loss itself is always just this awful pain. And everything that has come from this loss has been so astonishing.
Yeah, but the loss itself is not the end of the story. So the problem is when we isolate loss and make it its own reality.
Yes.
But loss exists in the context of love, right? So in that sense, it's beautiful because always is love is always like the glue in between everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Berilujah, Sorum, we have two more to go.
Oh, there's two more. There's two more.
We have so much homework today.
And there's so much, you know, it was so much fun, friend, coming up with these words. I had quite a few more. So these were the ones that were my favorites of them all.
I'm waiting for some type of glossary-like book you publish with each one of these words. And like,
a glossary is a book.
Renewed life or something.
There's a gorgeous book called The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, which is made of.
About it. Yeah, very interesting.
Oh, I cannot recommend it highly enough. In which it just does. It takes all of the. I will say though that you know, and it's in the title, The Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, and it does seem focused on sorrows. Uh-huh. And I feel like these words are maybe bent the other way. For instance, Samunion, which is from the Proto-Indo-European root sum, which is to sing, and then with union. Like communion. So Samunion is the praise that's inspired by connection with others, the world, the divine, and the many parts of ourselves, a sense of being in cooperation with the whole, the elation that arises when we trust everything belongs and transforms together, even the people, things, and circumstances we dislike or resist, and we are in service to that belonging and transformation.
Yeah,
that's a tough one, right? Who wants to believe that the things that we really deeply dislike, things that we're certain we would label evil and awful, that somehow we're a part of the whole with this? Mm. Of course we are. Of course we are. That's the nature of.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite lines from Richard Rohr on his book called Everything Belongs, basically, right? Like it's beautiful, it's poetic, but it's super challenging to walk that talk and to make space for especially what we feel it cannot belong. How can this belong? Even this.
How can this belong? Even this?
The more we question that, the more we become losers because We are part of that belonging with all our shortcomings. So yeah.
I mean, that's what's really asked of us. And that, well, friend, that's something I'm still working on. Yeah. And the last word is pangloria. Mm. Pan from Greek for everything.
Yeah.
And gloria. Praise that arises out of an ecstatic gratefulness for life. The ways we're intimately bonded with all. A strange certainty, there are opportunities for praise everywhere.
Mm.
Even where we would rather not look.
Mm.
So do we find it? Everywhere. Everywhere, everywhere. Even those places we're sure not, no, couldn't be here, could not be here.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great meditation. Like, okay, how can even this, whatever that may be, how can even this could be an invitation to praise, right? Like the word praise in itself invites to a reframing of whatever knocks on our door. Okay, this is a form of praise, and this is a form of inviting to a form of praise. And in my particular tradition, the word praise is very present, and you use the word some, and we also have this word some, and we sing a lot. It's a very crucial part of our practice to sing, to celebrate basically life. And there's even a Sanskrit word called Sankirtan, which basically means collective praise. Like we can sing on our own, but also sitting together, acknowledging mm-hmm. our interconnection and our common center. And some also can mean in Sanskrit complete, right? And for me, sometimes complete means, okay, we do it with other people, but also listening for you. A new meaning is coming, that Sankirtan, which means complete praise in the sense of a praise that does not exclude grief, sorrow, whatever, that can accommodate everything. Because again, sometimes by praise, we may think just the ecstatic joy and gratitude, which is also there, but some other elements cannot be part of praise. So real Sankirtan, yeah. Real all-inclusive praise has to host everything and everyone. Everything belongs. Yeah.
Everything belongs again. Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. Oh, thank you for sharing that with me. And yeah, the difference between that song alone, that song together, what are the ways that when we sing together, mm-hmm. literally and metaphorically, when we come together, like even a conversation like this
yeah.
is a singing together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's such a need for this type of things in the world we're living, the complex social dynamics we're living, especially we're here in the US, very complex dynamics here. Interestingly, the day we are recording this conversation is the day the Buddhist monks are finishing their walk for peace. So that's yes. another beautiful God incidence. So somehow yes. joining in the peace walk from our seats and having this conversation. Rosemary, if you have 1 minute, can we close as a way of closing? Generally, I'd love to
yes.
with a small kind of contemplative exercise. So sorry for using you as a guinea pig for my social experiments online.
Find me up.
The experiment began 2 hours ago almost, so it's fine. We are both part of it. So I'll offer you 10 short questions, very short. For each one, I invite you to reply with a short phrase, one word, a few words, related to okay. what that question stirs, reveals, awakens at this precise moment. Yeah? Ready?
Okay.
I gave you the warning. You're ready. Fasten your seatbelt.
Here I am.
Okay, present. What feels most vibrant for you at this chapter of your life?
Listening.
Hmm. What feels more vibrant for you at this precise moment?
This space right here around my heart, just right here in my body.
When was the last time you cried?
About 20 minutes ago.
The next question, which was the last time before that?
Oh, I think it was probably an hour and a half ago, 2 hours ago.
I'm not asking this to invade your privacy, just to normalize crying for all of us. Where do you feel closest to the sacred these days?
In the field, standing out in a field.
How can we die before we die?
How is your question?
Yeah.
Often.
Okay. Good. Great. What kind of laughter feels allowed inside sorrow?
All laughter. Yeah, I was about to make a little, not laughing at. There's a nasty, mean, cruel laughter. Maybe not that, but I don't know if I'm allowed to. I don't know if laughter wants me to put that kind of a restriction on it, but that's the.
Yeah.
That's.
What feels ready to be released in you?
Oh. I don't know.
Absolutely valid answer. Probably one we will all identify with. Two more. What is the deepest form of love you know?
The kind that arrives without us even asking, that's always here. Just it's always here.
What is your idea of eternity today? Sorry, these are big questions, and each one deserves.
They're so great. I think my mind has exploded.
I'm being cruel,
but
I'm being releasing my cruelty here. I'm sorry. One podcast per question, and I'm asking you 10 seconds answer. Sorry.
I mean, what is my idea of eternity today? It's as much right now as it is any other time.
So I like to end quoting one powerful one-liner from your book, The Unfolding, that for me somehow summarizes what we have been attempting to do today, and says, I have it here, to foster one moment of trust and love is to belong to a crucial revolution. Thanks so much, Rosemary, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Swami. Thank you.